You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel.
Where's Daniel?
Where is Daniel? Daniel is in the desert. He's in Abu Dhabi. We just say the desert, don't we? It's probably, I mean, he's probably in a city. But we're going to join Daniel in part two of today's podcast. He's going to link up with us from his, no doubt, very fancy hotel.
That's a relief.
In Abu Dhabi. Why is that a relief?
Well, he's going to be part of the episode.
We need our third wheel, don't we?
We do.
He's going to join us, and he's going to give us a couple of interviews that he's done with Ben Swift and Yusuf Mirza, both ride for the UAE team, which announced a new sponsor this week, the Emirates Airline. And we'll also hear from an old friend of the podcast, a good friend of the podcast in that part. We've got a lot to cover, as ever, this week. There's been a lot of racing. There's a lot of racing to look forward to as well, notably Het Nieuwsblad. Lionel, stop salivating, Lionel, at that. You're going out there for that, actually. We'll talk about Het Nieuwsblad in the final part. We will also hear in the final part from our colleague Eva Marisa, a Portuguese journalist, works for Eurosport there. She'll tell us a little bit about the Tour of the Algarve. So we'll talk about that in the final part. But before we talk about anything at all, let's have your news roundup, please, Lionel.
Certainly, Richard. Well, I'll wrap up the racing that was going on last week. Start with the Tour of the Algarve, which was won by Lotto NL Jumbo's Primoz Roglic. He really sort of came to our attention at the Giro last year, didn't he, when he won the individual time trial in Chianti on a very wet day. He laid the foundations for this victory really by getting away with Dan Martin on the day that the Irish rider won the uphill finish, and then kind of finished it off really with a solid enough ride in the time trial stage, which was won by Jonathan Castroviejo. Andre Greipel also won a stage in the Algarve. Meanwhile, at the Ruta del Sol in the south of Spain, Tim Wellens won the final stage there, but the race was really all about Alejandro Valverde. He won the opening stage, didn't he, last week, held the lead all week. Alberto Contador and Thibaut Pino, who won a very impressive mountain stage, pushed him hard, but Valverde there clinched his 100th win as a professional. Very impressive tally for Valverde. In the desert, just along from where Daniel is now, at the Tour of Oman, Alexander Kristoff won three stages for Katusha Alpecin, or Alpecin Katusha. Still don't know which way around that goes.
I'm not sure.
No, well, you know, somebody can correct us on Twitter. But Ben Hermans.
What was that?
What was that?
I think that sounded like Rob Hatch. And the pronunciation police are on your case, Lionel. Watch your step.
Ben Hermans of BMC Racing won overall there, ahead of Fabio Aru and Rui Costa. In France, the Tour du Haut Var two-day race at the weekend was won by Arthur Vichot. Samuel Dumoulin won a stage there. Off the bike, as you mentioned there, Richard, the UAE Abu Dhabi team is now going to be known as the UAE Team Emirates after wrapping up a sponsorship deal with the Fly Emirates airline. Also have another couple of sponsors that we'll mention a bit later on. We've heard also that the Liège-Bastogne-Liège route has been confirmed. There's a whole bunch of new climbs, none of which I'm terribly familiar with. The Côte de Pont, the Côte de Bellevaux, and the Côte de la Ferme-Libé are in. No Côte de Juan, no Côte de Haute-Levé, and the Stocco is again missing. So the run back in from Bastogne to Liège is significantly different this year. In other route news, well, we've got the Omloop Het Nieuwsblad coming up this weekend, the true start of the cycling season, and I'm particularly happy that the Molenberg is back. It was left off the route last year because of roadworks, but it's back in as the final climb, and it's always important strategically. It comes quite a long way from the finish, and there's a couple of really important cobble sections after it, but the Molenberg is back. Lovely little climb, that. British cycling's woes continue. We'll no doubt talk about this a bit more next week after Simon Cope and Dr. Richard Freeman have made their appearance before the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. inquiry into doping in sport. But this week, the head of UK Sport, Liz Nicol, has accused British Cycling of, I quote, a complete lack of transparency. And this relates to a report into bullying in 2012, which perhaps was not conveyed as fully as it should have been. We'll perhaps talk about that in coming weeks when a few more details are known. And finally, Orica Scott. Yes, got it right. Wow. First time.
I was expecting to hear Rob Hatch again there.
Well, no, I can pronounce it correctly. It's just that for quite a while last year, I was calling them Orica Bike Edge.
Orica Scott Exchange.
Orica Scott. Well, they've got an embarrassment of riches when it comes to who they can pick to lead the various Grand Tours this year. But according to Matt White, they've made their selection. And the story is that Adam and Simon Yates will both ride the Giro d'Italia. That leaves Esteban Chavez to ride the Tour de France, will make his Tour de France debut this summer. And all three of them will ride the Vuelta a España. It's a long way away at the moment, isn't it, that? But that's the plan. I for one, really hope that happens. I mean, a third of their team will be genuine contenders for the podium. I can't remember the last time. I'll have to think back. Think about when the last time a team had such great chances of putting multiple riders in the top 10.
1986 Tour de France, La Vie Claire. Four riders in the top 10, I think so,
yeah.
Yep. It's a good story, I guess, the Orica Scott strategy for this year. It's completely different, opposite to what we predicted, I think, a couple of weeks ago. I think we imagined that Chavez would ride the Giro. I think Daniel understood that Chavez wanted to ride the Giro, but he'll ride his first Tour de France. The Yates twins, as you say, Lionel, doubling up at the Giro and the Vuelta. I mean, there's no right answer here. It's impossible to know, I guess, how events are going to transpire, how these races are going to unfold. Chavez has a great record at the Vuelta, certainly. He rode a fantastic Giro last year. Normally, Chavez is perhaps not in that bracket of, you know, Quintana, Froome. He's not somebody who will start the Tour as an out-and-out favourite. And you might think, well, the Giro might be a more realistic race to try and win. And winning a Grand Tour is surely the aim, rather than just getting guys on the podium for Orica Scott.
Yes, but not necessarily winning this year. I'm quite impressed with Matt White's comments in explaining
You're not saying his name right, that's for sure.
Matt White.
Whitey.
Sorry. Is Rob Hatch going to come in there with a local dialect?
I don't think he's listening at the moment.
I thought he was just here over my shoulder. No.
You never know.
Well, but the thing is, it isn't necessarily about trying to win this year. They've got all three of these riders on long enough contracts that they can think about developing them into the future. And there's logic in exposing Adam and Simon Yates to the Giro, which is very different types of climbs, different style of racing. It will, you know, add to their armoury going forwards. And I think there's definitely, some method behind this. You know, they're not just thinking willy-nilly. They might, you know, who really can challenge Chris Froome and
Nairo Quintana. I think it's the name you're looking for there.
You know, they are, there's quite a bit of daylight between those two and the rest, even if you think that Contador and is still able to challenge them. But so far, Chavez hasn't really gone up against them. And the Tour de France, it's a different type of race. The pressure, the intensity, the type of stages and the way it's raced is different. And he has yet to experience that. So it's a bit like any skill. You have to stretch yourself, keep trying to progress, keep trying to learn. And it may well be that, say, doing a year where the Tour de France is a focus, he might come out of the Tour really in good shape to contend for the Vuelta, or it might well be that he does a Tour this year, and then next year he's added enough to be able to contend for the Giro d'Italia.
I think, of the three of them, Chavez is closest to being the finished article, isn't he? He's got a couple of years on the Yates twins. So from that point of view, it's logical to put him in the biggest race, the Tour de France. fascinating. It will be fascinating to see how the Yates twins ride together now, a few years into their career. They've tended to, you know, one or other has shone. We saw Adam Yates at the Tour last year, of course, and Sam Yates rode. I mean, Adam Yates got, you know, fourth overall, fantastic result. Sam Yates rode a different Vuelta, won a stage early on, and then, you know, held a high overall position as well while doing a great job for Chavez. So it's still, you still cannot separate those guys in terms of knowing, you know, it's a very tantalising prospect, that the idea that they both go into a three-week tour with equal form in equal condition and just see how they ride together. And, you know, it sets up again a fantastic Giro. Thibaut Pinot, you mentioned the news roundup, he's also another one down for the Giro. Really rode very well to claim Contador's scalp. He's not done that often enough, you know, beaten one of the real, I suppose, the big four, you know, Nibali, Froome, Quintana. Contador still regarded as the big four, the guys who can win Grand Tours. Pino rode a masterful race to beat Contador on a tough climb. So I think the Giro is a mouth-watering prospect.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoy, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science and Sport.
Science and Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We heard at the start of their message from Chris Hoy, Sir Chris Hoy, desperate to get on the Cycling Podcast. He's been so, best we could do was accommodate him in our little promotional bit for Science and Sport. He's a consultant for Science and Sport. Did an event with him in association with Science and Sport at the London Bike Show last week, which was great fun. And we did an interview with him as well, which we'll play in bits over the coming weeks. A reminder that Science and Sport are offering 20% off for all our listeners. If you go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code TCP20 at the checkout, you'll get 20% off. A couple of you had problems, I think, with the code last week, but there isn't an issue with it. But if you have problems with that, just let us know and we'll follow it up. But it's working fine. So TCP20 for 20% off. And thank you to Science and Sport for their support. So we're joined now, Lionel, by our lady in the desert.
Hello.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Daniel, how are you? You're in Abu Dhabi for the Abu Dhabi tour.
Fine.
You look like you're in a very luxurious setting there, the lobby of some fancy desert hotel.
It is. I mean, I should feel very excited and honoured to be in this hotel, or I would if I was a big Formula One fan, because it's a bit of a mecca for Formula One. And the Yas Marina circuit, this hotel is actually in the middle of the Yas Marina circuit, which I understand hosts the decisive Grand Prix of the Formula One season now every year. And we overlook, the hotel actually overlooks the track, and the riders have been training on the track today and yesterday, and there'll be a stage which actually takes place entirely on the track.
Never great spectacle, is it, racing on a motor racing circuit?
Somebody asked us on Twitter if there are any other races that had finished on motor racing tracks other than the prologue of the 2009 Tour de France, which was on the Monaco
been
street
quite a lot.
Circuit. Yeah, they have. I was racking
my
brain.
Yeah, a lot of Giro stages.
Yeah, 1989 Tour de France, went to the Spa-Francorchamps circuit in Belgium, and Raoul Alcala won the stage there. I was at Paris-Nice a few years ago, I think 2014, when they finished a stage on the circuit at Manicourt, yeah, near Nevers. John Degenkolb won that day. And the Vuelta, I think this was also 2009, started on the motorcycling circuit at Assen in the Netherlands, or Assen in the Netherlands. Not sure how you say that.
Assen.
But yeah, road races don't tend to work terribly well because they're too wide, really, aren't they? Motor sport circuits, but
yeah, they're built for faster vehicles. But Daniel, quite a field assembled there for the Abu Dhabi Tour. We're speaking on Wednesday. The race begins on Thursday, so it'll be well underway by the time a lot of people are listening to this. But it is a very good field assembled for this race, which has moved in the calendar. I mean, it used to be October, didn't it? Why has that change come about, and why and how has it managed to attract such a good field?
Well, I think the reason there are so many good riders here, it owes primarily, or at least partly, to the agreement that Velon have with RCS. And Velon, this group of 10 teams now, isn't it? And they have an agreement with RCS whereby each team is pretty much obliged to send a star name, one big name. And that's certainly why a lot of teams have sent their leading lights. And there are other riders who just decided, for example, Alberto Contador decided pretty much at the last minute or a week or so ago that he fancied doing this race to get a few more kilometres in the legs. And, you know, I think for reasons linked to the weather as well and the convenience of Oman, the Tour of Oman, which has just finished being, well, just over the border, really. In fact, it's going to be a mountaintop finish here in Abu Dhabi that finishes pretty much up the same mountain that the Tour of Oman finished up one day, Green Mountain. I think it's called Hafit Jebel on this side, on the Abu Dhabi side. So, yeah, I mean, several reasons, really. And then also, of course, World Tour points up for grabs, which is becoming increasingly important.
And you spoke to a couple of riders out there. I mean, one of the talking points this week has been the announcement of a new sponsor or new sponsors for the UAE team. They are sponsored by Fly Emirates, who are all over, as you think you pointed out on Twitter yesterday, they're all over sport, aren't they? I think within the sport of cycling, been a few teams and managers chasing that that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And this team that's been sort of cobbled together from a failed sort of Chinese project, they've got Fly Emirates now on the kit, and that was obviously timed to coincide with their with the race in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, there was a big launch yesterday. So Emirates have come on board, and big press conference. Giuseppe Saroni is the manager of the team. He, what was formerly the Lamprey team, morphed into this UAE team and is now UAE Emirates team. He is obviously delighted. Mauro Giannetti, who has an interesting past in cycling, was a rider, then the manager of the Vinnie Calderola team, then Saunier Duval, and now he's reappeared as, well, a sort of promoter, a sort of fixer figure who's put Emirates and also the UAE together with Saroni, and now, they found themselves with an enviable position, a very big sponsor, which is committed for 3 years, I think, initially, and several sub-sponsors as well from the UAE. And with the idea, with the goal, this team's always really had the goal of promoting cycling in the UAE. It's not a country which you would think lends itself particularly well to cycling. It's very much set up for cars. The weather is obviously not ideal either. But, you know, they're convinced, the various parties involved with the team from the UAE are convinced that this can be a vehicle to promote a healthier lifestyle in particular. I mean, this is a part of the world that's become very prosperous over the last few years. And as it has done that, the obesity problems, diabetes problems have increased and at an alarming rate, I understand. So, yeah, one of the declared goals of the team is to promote cycling and promote a healthier lifestyle.
So, Daniel, presumably part of the interest for the UAE team is to develop riders who can compete on a World Tour level as well, because without riders, they're not going to necessarily get the support based at home that they're going to need to be a sustainable team.
You're right, Lionel. And as soon as UAE Abu Dhabi came into being, the team started looking actively for a rider from the UAE or Abu Dhabi, and they found a young man called Yusuf Mirza, who's been around for a few years running continental teams. He's actually not riding in the Abu Dhabi Tour for a curious reason. When they signed him, which was obviously late, the sponsor came on board pretty late, it wasn't far enough in advance of the Abu Dhabi Tour for him to register for their biological passport for World Tour events. Riders have to register 45 days before the start of a World Tour event in order to be available for testing. He only registered, I think, 32 days before the start of the Abu Dhabi Tour, so he couldn't be selected. He's obviously very disappointed about that, but he was there yesterday at the launch. He's a guy with an interesting story, an interesting backstory. A few years ago, he was working at the airport here in Abu Dhabi for the immigration department. He's also someone who's had a fair bit of adversity in his life. He lost his parents, both of his parents, at a young age, but really found an escape and found solace and found a real passion in professional cycling. And very much enjoyed listening to him tell his story yesterday.
I'm working in government, in Abu Dhabi government, and now I'm a cyclist. But I think 6-7 years ago, I finished my work. The sports, the cycling sports, really, it's new for UAE, even for Dubai or Abu Dhabi or other Emirates. But really, it's new. But now the government and sports responsibilities, they are start to think that this sport is more important, not more than football, but it's important. And they start to build a course, special course for bike, like Al Wathba. Really, I like when I was a kid, I see my brother, my older brother, Badr, he going to ride a bike. So I want to, but my parents don't let me go out because I'm still young, 8 years old. But after that, I'm every day say I want. After that, they let me go with him. After that, I start with the cycling, in a club, in really normal club, in a college club. It's from Sharjah government. After that, after 5 years, I moved to Dubai for Al Ahli club. It's Al Ahli cycling. Went to skydiving last year, I think. After 5 years also in Al Ahli, I moved to Al Nasr cycling. From there, we upgrade the team Al Nasr from amateur to continental team. So the most good thing for me, I going step by step, from amateur to conti to professional. That's why I know how is the level of races. It's not all same. When you race with amateur, it's different. It's fast, but it's different how when you're racing with a professional. Because in a professional, every rider have a mission, and that's it, But in amateur, it's full gas from start to finish line. Everyone now is, support me, like my family, my wife, my son. So I had a son 2 years old. So now is, when you get support from everywhere, it's the point. So I growing up with my brothers only. So, but no problem, it's fine. And when sometime don't have a mother and father, but you want to show yourself better than others, They have parents, but when you're growing up like this with your brothers, with your families, you have to do something special for them. The sports of cycling, it's new, but now it's growing, really growing up, really growing fast. This sport in schools, in towns, in villages, in east of UAE, in Ras Al Khaimah, I can see now we have a social media, it's easy. You can see all news or all photos. I can see some kids riding the bikes even with families in Dubai, even in Abu Dhabi. But the hard thing, it's for the families to let for the parents to let them to let the sons or daughters make a sport. This sport is really dangerous, but it's about a mentality. It's in Europe we cannot comparing the mentality from big countries like Europe and like Emirates. But the Emirates now they are changing the mentality for the lifestyle of a healthy style. You can see that, you can feel this country, how is growing fast with this sport. Not only with cycling, really, with all sports, I can see.
So that was Yusuf Mirza, the local rider for the UAE, not easy to say that, is it? UAE Fly Emirates team, and they've got other sponsors as well, haven't they? On board, they announced some.
They have
a motley, a motley crew of sponsors.
A couple of weeks too late to be included in our ethical report on the team sponsors.
I think that was definitely deliberate.
Well, one is a company called ADS Securities, which is a big investment company based in the United Arab Emirates. And the other one, which, is it the first defence and security company? I mean, that's shorthand for kind of arms dealing, really, isn't it? Weapons and
never,
security.
Never saw Ben Swift as being the face of a weapons company.
No. The company is called International Golden Group, and if you have a look on their website, there are pictures of tanks and helicopters with frightening-looking guns. Obviously, looking at professional cycling as the ideal vehicle to promote their weapons.
Do their weapons hit their target or just fall narrowly short, a bit like Ben Swift at Milan San Remo?
Oh, cruel.
That is unkind because you spoke to Ben Swift, Daniel. Milan San Remo was a big target for him. Shall we hear from him now, then come back and talk about the team a little bit?
Few eyebrows were raised when you took the decision to leave Sky. I don't know how and to what extent it was forced upon you, but you've ended up in this UAE team. A real fresh start for you, no?
No, definitely a fresh start. I was in Team Sky for 7 years, and like I've said in the past, it was a really hard decision to leave the what was technically my home team. You know, I had 7 great years there, and we left on really good terms, and they've wished me well, I wish them well, you know. But like you say, it's a fresh start, a new environment, new colleagues, new management staff, everything's a complete new. I've obviously got to brush up on my Italian and keep working away on
that. Rusty after a few years?
Yeah, you could say that. It's quite fortunate in one sense that it was Italian, because I've got that basic understanding of it, but working pretty hard on it, and I kind of get the general gist of what they're going on about most of the time. So.
And at the start of your career, Ben, in a way you had a bit of an experience similar to this one, then you joined Katusha. That surprised people as well, and it surprised people that you did so well there straight away. I mean, did that make it easier to take a big jump into a team like this one, a foreign team, and you know, in an environment where which you're not particularly familiar with?
Yeah, I think so. I've had that experience. I've obviously been in Bola World and in Katusha, so I wasn't scared of that change of environment and that sort of stuff, because at the end of the day, we're all doing the same job, really. It's just different faces and different environments. So for me, it was nice to be given the opportunity, and to UAE, Fly Emirates really, really wanted me. You know, they pursued me quite a lot, and that was quite nice and refreshing to have that sort of that desire from their side as well. You know,
and we mentioned the injuries earlier. You know, people have probably not been aware of how bad the injuries have been, and I think particularly your shoulder has hampered you more than anything else. Is that right? And when it seemed like last year you'd overcome some of those problems.
Yeah, no, definitely the shoulders have been an issue to me, but I was having a good think about it, and it's because I'm generally always in the thick end of it. I never have any simple crashes. You know, my last 4 crashes have all been 65k an hour plus, so it's all, you're not really often going to walk away from them unscathed. My actual last crash was my knee. It was very, very nearly broken, my knee. I think it's just part of one of those things where at a high level sport we stress our bodies a lot, and then once you do have a couple of injuries, that joint is going to be a little bit weaker, and then if you land on it again, then there's a high probability that it's going to go again.
Am I right in thinking that the shoulder problems originally, they were caused by one, or the origin of them was one particularly bad crash?
The first one was, well, I've done it twice on each shoulder, so it's not 4 times on one shoulder. We since found out that just my genetics, my shoulder joints is a little bit more oval shaped rather than round, so if I do land in the wrong sort of position, then my shoulder dislocates slightly easier. Then
which one was the crash, Ben? The first one?
The first one was just in training, just crashed on some ice in 2011. I put my hand down and then it just went straight out the back, and it's just one of those things where I've had to do a lot of rehab. The surgery, we've tightened the shoulders up a little bit, so hopefully I can withstand them. You know, it's not every time I crash. I've had plenty of crashes, and seems to be like one out of five that I do myself some damage.
And obviously being a sprinter of sorts, it's been a particular problem, hasn't it? I mean, is that where it's hurt you most over the past couple of years?
I think so. Obviously that strength in the shoulders and stuff, but luckily I've been able to manage the pain right. Had to ride with it a lot and have the operations in the winter, and you kind of you deal with that as and when it was. But it's just one of those things, really. I just kind of not dwell on it and just see it as an opportunity that you can do some focus training, really, on the turbo.
Just finally, Ben, it's been a couple of years, 3 years, I think, since you finished a Grand Tour. What's your schedule look like on that front this year? Which one are you going to do, or which ones?
Yeah, so at the moment, the tour's back. Looking like it's going to be on my program, so early season kind of focused around San Remo. Kind of having that focus, it opens the door for a lot of races for me, you know, like, because you've got to be in good condition there, so you'd be in good condition for Pyrenees, for Pays Basco, for the Ardennes. So they're kind of races that I look to perform well in, and then build up towards the tour, and then the end of the season we re-look at it again later.
Okay, that was Ben Swift, one of the nicest men in professional cycling, I think. And I was only joking about him following Narrowly Short. As he said there, he's only ridden Milan-San Remo three times and finished on the podium twice.
And finished in the top 10 every time.
Yeah, and some might argue that he was very unlucky last year if some of the allegations about Arnaud Démare were correct. He was unlucky not to win Milan-San Remo last year, perhaps. And maybe he'll go, why are you smiling, Daniel?
Nothing. I've just seen someone. Yeah. Anyway,
star spotting in the lobby.
He's
there,
gazing,
are you,
gazing wistfully there. I don't know who it was he spotted, but it must be somebody special. I think Ned Bolting. Anyway, Daniel, this team. You know, as you said, it's morphed from the old Lamprey team. I feel like we're losing him here, don't you?
No, he's not paying attention.
Try and catch somebody's eye. Mm. But it's morphed from the old Lamprey team. They've got a. Lamprey was always a sort of team that seemed to be a bit of a graveyard for a lot of riders, bit of a motley crew. You've got Louis Menquez there, you've got Rui Costa, you know, good riders, but what do you see that team as being substantially different to the old Lamprey team in terms of, you know, how they're managed? What, you know, Ben Swift is obviously somebody who's been signed partly for his points but also his ability to win races.
I think they'll do very well, actually. I mean, they've got a pretty broad spectrum of riders. They've got a lot of very fast riders. Sacha Modolo, Ben Swift, Marco Kump is a very quick rider, Ferrari. So they've got various sprinters. They've got some good young riders. Ravazzi is a very promising young Italian rider. Filippo Ganna, of course, the World Pursuit champion. And then they've also got Ulisi, Rui Costa, and Minkes. And it's actually one of the most versatile rosters, one of the most well-rounded rosters in the World Tour. But are they spread too thinly? I mean, you compare them with a team like Astana or Bahrain, who have really decided to put all of their eggs pretty much in one basket. In those two cases, the Grand Tours and the Giro. The UAE team is trying to do an awful lot, and they could end up with a very successful season or very little. It's one of those teams, I would say.
They haven't really got a Grand Tour overall contender, have they? But they've certainly got stage winning potential, and if they wanted somebody just to ride up into the top sort of half dozen, Menkes can do that. You know, Atapuma did well at the Giro last year. You know, they've got a lot of kind of diesel-y type riders, haven't they, that can that may not necessarily punch particularly hard, but they can certainly be consistent in stage races.
Yeah, and looking forward, looking beyond this year, the Emirates deal is not really going to kick in until next year, in the sense that the money that has come from Emirates is not really going to be available for recruitment until next year. At the moment, it's about a 9 million or 10 million euro a year team, and it's going to be significantly more next year. So, and quite a few riders who are going to be out of contract at the end of the year. I think Rui Costa is going to be out of contract. Minkes is going to be out of contract. So we'll probably see a fair number of changes next year.
Conti is a good rider, good young rider, isn't he? Valerio Conti rode very well.
Well, he really came into his own last year. I mean, he's been talked up. He was One of Fabio Aru's big rivals as an amateur, was considered by some to be even more talented than Aru, hasn't really done it at professional level, or he hadn't until last year, and he rode a very solid Giro and then won a stage in the Vuelta, of course. So he's another name that I would look out for this
and
year.
And Filippo Ganna, you mentioned him. He won the Pursuit at the World Track Championships last year. Really phenomenal looking rider. He's only 20 years old. He looked incredibly strong. Maybe another sort of Gianni Moscon, who's obviously another young Italian talent.
Well, I think he's someone that we will see a lot of in Paris-Roubaix in the coming years, Filippo Ganna, and maybe races like the Tour of Flanders as well.
Well, I mean, these riders, you know, who are out there, Daniel, obviously a great field, but there's another big name from the cycling world out there, isn't there?
A huge name who's sitting only a few meters away, but I can't, unfortunately, I can't disturb him at the moment. But I did have the good fortune to talk to him earlier in the day. You know who I'm talking about?
I think we do.
Three guesses?
I think we do. It's Ciro Scognamiglio from Gazzetta dello Sport.
Well, Ciro, this is almost the perfect race for you because we're meeting at the Abu Dhabi Tour. We're staying in a very plush, very luxurious hotel that overlooks a Formula One circuit. Not a mountain in sight. There is going to be one on Saturday, unfortunately. So how much are you looking forward to this Abu Dhabi Tour?
Yes, Daniel, not bad. But comparing to the last edition, because it's my second time here, my first edition I was not here, but last year, yes. And for me, there is a big difference, not about riders, not about stages, not about this stuff, but about the fact that my hotel last year was near the beach. And this year, I can't see the beach from my hotel, listeners. So this week, really, really difficult for me.
Right. Ciro, as always, after three questions, I'm going to have to steer you back onto serious stuff. Away from the beaches and on to, and we are unfortunately going to have to talk about cycling now. One of the interesting features about this race is the fact that Fabio Aru and Vincenzo Nibali are going up against each other for different teams now. Now, I saw them before the press conference today. We had a pre-race press conference, and they looked very friendly. They looked as though they're on very good terms. They were laughing, joking. You were also laughing and joking with them. So are we to conclude that the big rivalry that all the Italian fans want to see at the Giro d'Italia is going to be a friendly rivalry?
I think so. And in my opinion, I don't know if it's a good think or not. I explain this because we know that in the past, history of cycling, but also history of Italian cycling, has been made in these years of a lot of rivalry. The big last one was Pugno and Chiappucci, but also Moser and Saronni. And these guys, you know, when they spoke, one against the other one, always in terms of sportive question, to be loyal, but, they were a lot of, how can I say, a little bit more aggressive in the quotes between them. And this was nice, for the fans and also for themselves, because this helped their popularity. As a matter of fact, Fabio and Vincenzo are different. Certainly at the beginning of their relationship in Astana, because they stayed 4 years together, maybe their relationships was not so good. But as a matter of fact, especially in the last year, they had the possibility to share the experience also in the Olympics with the Italian jersey. They became, I don't want to say friend, maybe it's not the correct word, but their relationships is really good.
And was it at the Olympics where things really changed? Because I remember the interview that Nibali did with Bici Sport magazine last year, and we talked about it at the time. There were some quite inflammatory quotes about Fabio Aru. He said that Aru had a real temper, that he got upset very quickly, very easily, and he would shout at teammates and so forth and so forth. And that was quite controversial at the time, wasn't it? I don't imagine that Aru took those quotes, those comments from Nibali very well.
No, not really. And as a matter of fact, also before the Milan San Remo of last year, in an interview with the Gazzetta, more or less Nibali said the same thing. like the same stuff, but maybe sharing together the experience of the Tour de France before and then of the Olympics, maybe something has changed. And also before in the press conference, Nibali said that with Fabio they could also try to to do the same tactic in the same race against the other rivals of other teams. So who knows, we could also see this kind of help between themselves against the other riders, against Quintana, against Contador. I don't know, in my opinion, it will be difficult to see this, but who knows.
And just finally, Giro, we're looking forward to the Giro, obviously, talking about Aru and Nibali. Would you agree that they're both riding now for weaker teams than they were riding for a year ago? Aru is obviously still at Astana, but Astana is weaker than it was last year. And the Bahrain Merida team, it's a new team. Nibali is obviously the poster boy, the talisman of that team. But it doesn't look a terribly strong roster.
Well, Daniel, it's incredible how your analysis can be really clever and really up to date, and they really go to the point, because I perfectly agree with you. As a matter of fact, Astana, in my opinion, on the paper, so it's weaker than in the last year, because we have to remember that Astana lost some important names in this year. Let's think to Nibali, but also Rosa, also Landa. I mean, they are not longer in Astana. And also Bahrain Merida. I mean, it's not really a top level team as their roster. I mean, certainly they are in the first year of their experience, so it's not easy to create such a strong team in that first year. We remember also the first year of Team Sky. Certainly Sky was not as strong as they are now. So in a certain way, their teams are a little bit weaker, yes, and for this 100th edition of the Giro, there will be a lot of strong team, because there are a lot of captains. There will be a strong Movistar for Quintana, a strong Trek Segafredo for Mollema, and so on. So I think it will be difficult. But listeners, believe me, this year the Giro is really better than the Tour de France, and certainly I'm not talking about only riders, Daniel, because
I think we better leave it there. I think we all know what you're talking about, Ciro.
Exactly, Daniel. Imagine three stages in Sardinia and two stages in Sicilia. I mean, for me,
let's try and impart some useful information. There will be some people listening to this who might want to go to the Giro.
Yeah.
Right. If they had to choose between Sardinia and Sicilia, and there are a few beautiful beaches that the race will be going quite close to. If you had to choose one location in either of those two islands that we're going to go close to on the Giro, where would you go?
I mean, these are the really interesting question. Finally, I mean, I'm really happy. So Sardinia, certainly, you know, the start is from Alghero. It's the northern part of Sardinia. And so my advice is to go to the Maddalena Island. It's not very from Olbia, that it will be the stage finish of the first stage. So Maddalena is the best part.
It's miles from the race, Giro. Maddalena is on the other side of the island.
Exactly, but it's in front of Sardinia, and from Olbia, 30 minutes by car, then 20 minutes by ferry. And so certainly you can't see the riders, but who cares, dear listeners? It's not important. But if you want to see riders, my bet, I don't know, I can't understand why, but okay. So Alghero, it's my bet for Sardinia. The start of the first stage is also, the sea is marvelous, and also the village is really good from Sardinia. And from Sicily, close to Messina, stage finish number 5, you are in front of the Aeolian Island, and so you consider, so these are my bets, Alghero and Messina. And the last thing, to come back to what I was saying before, imagine in the Tour de France of this year, only the stage of Marsiglia, the last time trial before Paris.
Okay, enough. I'm going to shut you down because I can see where this is going.
Oh, well, it's lovely to hear from Ciro Scognamiglio again. he will come into his own at the Giro, won't he?
Yeah, it feels like the season started now. Giro's been on the podcast. Het Nieuwsblad only a few days away. Cycling is back.
Mouth watering.
Brilliant.
Well, Daniel, listen, have a great time out there in Abu Dhabi. We'll look forward to hearing more next week from your adventures in the desert. I'm sure you'll be gathering lots of great interviews and things over the next few days, and we'll report back in with you next week. Thanks very much. Have a good one.
Thanks, chaps.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much indeed to our main sponsor, Rafa. Extremely grateful to them for their ongoing support of the Cycling Podcast. We're looking forward to a relaunch in a few weeks as well, aren't we, Lionel? Going to have a bit of a freshen up, spring cleaning.
Yeah, a little bit of a different sound to the jingles and that kind of thing.
Same old nonsense.
In between the jingles. We can't do much about that.
And on that note, it was nice to hear from Daniel there, wasn't it? Very lovely.
Oh, his enthusiasm's just inspiring.
he's out there in Abu Dhabi.
Sorry, Daniel.
Oh, wow.
That was just a joke.
He's not going to be listening, don't be silly. Anyway, it was nice to hear from Daniel, and we'll hear more from Daniel next week. A bit of housekeeping. We released our latest cycling podcast, Femina, this week. That was our February episode. It's monthly with myself and Orla Shinoui. We were joined this month by Abby Van Twisk, the drops rider who's been racing already this year down in Australia. It was good to have her insight. We had interviews as well with the world champion, Amelie Diederichsen. We had Katie Archibald as well, and we heard also from Tracy Godfrey and Mick Bennett, we played a bit of the Mick Bennett interview last week, slightly longer in the cycling podcast Femina, and we spoke a bit more about the women's tour's bid to extend to 7 days, which was rejected by British Cycling. Have spoken to British Cycling in the last week about that, and they are adamant that their strategy is to discourage events from growing too fast too soon. They're all about sustainable growth. They want to be absolutely confident that a race is going to be sustainable as a 7 day event rather than becoming a 7 day event, maybe going back to 5 days again. I don't know what their criteria are for establishing that, but that's what they say is behind the decision. A couple of points that Orla made that are perhaps relevant as well. She made these in the podcast about the women's tour for all that has great crowds in the UK. Very little international interest in terms of TV rights and so on. I think the sport's come a long way, the women's sport's come a long way in Britain, and it's still got a way to go in other markets. I mean, Inner Ring, the blogger Inner Ring made a very good point that the two biggest race organisers in the world, ASO and RCS, show really very, very little interest indeed in women's cycling for whatever reason. So we've perhaps got a false impression in this country, in the UK, of just how big it is. It's still got a long way to go.
But why not then encourage it to be big in the country where it's already pretty strong?
Well, yeah, I completely agree with that. And also, I think, you know, ASO and RCS could do with coming to the Women's Tour and just seeing how big it is and what potential it has. And, you know, it's not too much of a leap of the imagination to think that events like that would be equally popular elsewhere. But anyway, that's all covered in the Cycling Podcast Femina this month. Just a note on last week's podcast, we had a report in there from Hannah Troop at the Dubai Tour on the Novo Nordisk team, the diabetic team. We had some really nice feedback on that little report from people like Jim Hamner, Paul Nesfield. A lot of people got in touch who are diabetics themselves or who have kids who are diabetic, and I think they really appreciated hearing that story and, you know, listening to the riders talk about how they cope with their diabetes, how they treat it, even sometimes mid-race. It was really interesting and you know, I'm sure it's a team we'll continue to follow. So listen, this final part, Daniel?
Steady on.
Less hair. Lionel, in this final part, we were going to talk a bit about the Algarve, where we had the tour of the Algarve over the last week. I spoke actually to Eva Marisa. I mentioned her at the start, Eurosport journalist. I was particularly interested in the victory by Amaro Antun, the FC Porto rider, and that team. You know, obviously associated with the football club of the same name.
Yeah, this is a bit of a Portuguese phenomenon, this, because in the past there's been teams that have been affiliated with the Benfica Football Club, Boa Vista Football Club as well, Sporting Lisbon. A lot of sports clubs in Portugal and to an extent in Spain, they're not just football clubs, they have teams that do other sports. But in Portugal it seems to be quite a tradition, really, and you know, they are effectively the FC Porto cycling team, aren't they?
And according to Eva, perhaps applying for a pro-continental licence next year. Who knows? We'll wait and see. Also, Sporting Lisbon have a team again, and she thought that Benfica might come back as well at some point. So well, let's hear from Eva Marisa, shall we? Here she is.
Tell us about FC Porto, the team, because there is a bit of a tradition in Portugal of football clubs having, I guess, wider sports clubs, but cycling teams as part of them.
Yes, indeed. In Portugal, I think it's one of the few countries that has had that relationship in the past with sporting clubs, which in Portugal, football takes much a big chunk, let's put it that way, of the clubs, but they still have other sports in the clubs, and cycling has been one of them. It's an interesting relationship because we don't see it in many other countries, and it's unfortunate because it actually raises awareness a lot, and I think it brings the fans closer to the club.
I mean, obviously the football clubs have huge fan bases, huge numbers of supporters. Do those supporters get behind the cycling team as well? Do you see that sort of happening by the roadside?
Oh, absolutely. The rivalry that happens with the football team is actually, it translates to the roads in the cycling races. And it's very interesting to see people rooting for their club, even people who were not initially interested in cycling, but you know how aficionados are about football. So it definitely translates as far as the roads, you know, in terms of racing.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously a huge result for FC Porto, their continental team in the final stage, the hilltop finish. Amaro Antunes, you were giving me pronunciation lessons, his name.
Yes, you're very close.
very close. So what did that victory mean? And I mean, how big a story was that?
Pretty huge, not only because Amaro Antunes was already, it's not so much of a revelation, but a kind of a confirmation, let's put it that way. He's 26 years old. He's a professional since, I believe, 2011. And last year he came to Algarve and basically competed with the best in Malian. He was just fourth, which that performance really took some people by surprise. But it's not a surprise when you realize that he's racing at home. He's from Algarve. He trains that hill every single week, and this time around he got everything perfectly. He attacked 1.5k's from the finish line, and basically nobody could follow him in those gradients at 9.5, and he was cheered all the way. The whole climb had his name written on it in the tarmac. It was pretty impressive.
Interesting stuff, Rich. There were a few talking points from the Tour of the Algarve, weren't there? It was a very entertaining race. Dan Martin continued Quick-Step's, you know, really impressive start to the season. They've won a lot of races, head and shoulders above everybody else so far. And Dan Martin off to a good start. His time trial undid his overall ambitions in the race, though. But he also was on Twitter making the point that the motorbikes carrying the, TV motorbikes, but also other motorbikes that accompany the peloton were just too close. And it did seem to be a recurring theme in the Algarve last week. Andre Greipel posted on Twitter a screen grab of Roglic in the time trial with the motorbike very, very close in front of him. And Ryan Mullen, the Irish rider with the Cannondale team, you could argue that the bunch was given a bit of a tow when they were closing the gap down
certainly
to him on
Seth
the day
Van
he
Mark,
was away.
His teammate thought so, yeah.
Seth Van Mark made that point. And where it's difficult to know without talking to the riders, it's something that we'll keep an eye on over the next few weeks, but whether this was just a local problem with the motorbikes in that race, perhaps the commissaires not doing their job vigorously enough, certainly something that now that the riders are talking about it and making the point, and because social media gives them the platform to do so, and you know, screen grabbing shots off the TV and making their point heard, you know, it's easy for them to bring it to the attention. Roglic won that race overall. I should just remind people, if they didn't listen to our coverage of the Giro last year when he won that time trial, he's the former ski jumper who
he'd do well on the jump, wouldn't he?
Well, that's it. Yeah, I mean, a seamless segue into... We haven't mentioned Bradley Wiggins' fleeting performance.
We haven't
on
actually
the jump.
Mentioned that at all in the last few weeks. I think that's been a real gaping hole in your news roundup, Lionel.
I watched
the first episode of the jump.
I've been thoroughly
enjoyed it.
Convenient leg fracture. I don't know whether there can be such a thing, but it has got him out of some of the more challenging, taxing, more dangerous aspects of this show. If you're not from the UK, or if you do something a bit more, entertaining on a Sunday night than sit down and watch the jump on Channel 4, you'll not know what we're talking about. But basically, it's a sort of Winter Olympics themed celebrity reality show where celebrities, and I use that term relatively loosely in some cases, they do the luge and the skeleton bob and skiing and, you know, all other sort of Winter Olympic disciplines. And Wiggins has a keen skier. apparently, I had no idea about this until.
Skier. I don't think he'd ever skied before, had he?
I believe he
had. Kids from Kilburn don't go to the Alps on skiing holidays, Lionel. Haven't you been following his story?
A little too closely of late, perhaps. Yeah. But yeah, he's no longer in the jump. Roglic, a former ski jumper, was pretty good at it, wasn't he? And off to a great start this season, and certainly one to watch. I believe he'll be riding the Giro again in support of Stephen Kruiswijk in the Lotto NL Jumbo team.
But he showed in Algarve that there's a bit more to him than... being a time trialist, I think he's got a lot. I think the team recognises he's got a lot of headspace, a lot of room to develop. I think, you know, he's obviously very, very strong. He has to develop his skills in the bunch and so on. Obviously, as someone who's come to it fairly late, I was quite surprised by not just Roglic. What are we saying? We need Rob Hatch for this, but Victor Campenaert as well in the Ruta del Sol won the time trial there. Surprise, another young rider. And I said a few weeks ago, I think when we were looking ahead to the season, that they were a pretty threadbare-looking squad. They've got rid of a couple of, you know, very established sort of totemic riders. Someone like Sepp van Marck, for example, the team seemed to sort of be built around him, certainly in the spring. And I'm surprised to see them. They've obviously had faith in these riders, thought that they were going to deliver, and Kruiswijk as well, of course. And he might... Well, do you know that might have been sometimes a guy like, without knowing what goes on behind the scenes, sometimes a guy like Sepp van Marck, who has promised so much and not really delivered the big win, sometimes somebody like that can just soak up too much, too many resources, too much energy, and him going has maybe given these other riders a bit of an opportunity.
Yeah, I think, you know, from our point of view, you see riders. I mean, Campenaerts has done well in individual time trials over the last year or so. But obviously, the teams themselves know the talents of their riders far greater than we do. And, you know, we're picking up when we're watching races, when we're seeing the results, picking up emerging riders, looking for the threads and the themes. But one of the things when I was with Lotto Soudal, the Belgian Lotto team, back in December in Mallorca at their training camp, one of the things that when I was chatting to Mark Sargent, the boss of the team, about how he was developing young riders, it's similar to what I was saying earlier in the episode about extending Chavez's experience incrementally and then putting him back into a familiar environment. So we basically stretch him by putting him in the Tour, and then in future he can go to the Giro, you know, that bit more developed. And Mark Sargent was talking about that in the case of a lot of his young riders. And that's something they've done with Tim Wellens. You know, Tim Wellens went to the Giro last year, won a stage, you know, with an impressive break. And now this year he's getting leadership roles in...
He was a Pedaleur de Charme as well.
He was a Pedaleur de Charme, yeah.
A very gracious one, I seem to recall.
Indeed, very polite young man. And, you know, this year we're already seeing he's hit the ground running. Or, you know, when you look at how well Lotto Soudal have started the season, you know, he's winning races, won a stage of the Ruta del Sol this past week. And it'll be really interesting to see how he steps on this year, and there's a lot of riders like that, and you can see the logic in how they develop. You know, give them the opportunity, see how they go, and then you know, continue stretching.
The logic, I'm getting confused.
Roglic or logic?
Yeah, you can see the Roglic. No coincidence that Lotto Soudal have hit the ground running and are doing very well, given that they feature in our first friend special of the year, 2017.
A two-part friend special.
Thank you very much to everybody who has signed up as a friend for 2017, £10 for the year. Episode 1 of 11 has been released, as I said, Lotto Soudal. We've got a few more coming up. I did a very good interview the other day for one that's going to be coming out just before the Giro, Lionel.
I'm looking forward to hearing that, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Daniel's working, beavering away on a couple of... good ones, and yeah, we've got some more coming up themed around the classics. You've got obviously the Lionel of Flanders is coming up, and speaking of Flanders, sorry, I should say thecyclingpodcast.com for to sign up as a friend of the podcast.
It's only £10. You get access to those 11 episodes, and who knows, maybe a few bonus little nuggets as the year unfolds.
I think there's going to be a few little bonus interviews there. You know, some of the longer interviews we do, but we can't play full thing in the episode. We're going to put them behind the paywall. You're off
just
to...
while we're on the just.
Oh, sorry.
I don't want to give an overly hard sell, but it did strike me. I was listening to the cycling podcast Feminin and realizing that a year ago that didn't exist, did it, Rich? And really, it was the support of friends of the podcast that enabled us to start that show. So, you know, that's basically where the money is going. It's helping us. It ensures that we can go and cover all three Grand Tours. We can't exist on sponsorship alone. The challenges of funding, the coverage of races, you know, it's a jigsaw, isn't it? A jigsaw of funding. So anyone who wants to sign up as a friend of the podcast, you are supporting what we do, and we are very grateful for that.
You're sending Lionel to live on a houseboat in Flanders for a couple of weeks. You're also sending him
of weeks, only 5 days.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was longer. You're also off to Het Nieuwsblad. I'm off to Paris Nice in a couple of weeks. Cannot wait for that, actually. I'm really excited. Probably to do with having had a baby quite recently. A little bit of time away, some sleep, that'd be nice. But you're off to Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday, Lionel. And of course, that for a lot of people is where the season really starts. It's the first cobbled classic of the year. We've got Het Nieuwsblad Saturday. We've got Kern of Brussels Kern on Sunday. It's a rider who won in Kern last year, Jasper Stuyven, who is my sort of outsider for Het Nieuwsblad. He's a very strong rider, very strong team, Trek Segafredo. I think look out for him. Another young rider, Gianni Moscon, I think, is another one to look out for in these races. Perhaps more Kern of Brussels Kern, who knows? Although it's usually a sprint, admittedly. Another rider, Dylan Groenewegen.
Dylan Groenewegen.
I think that's a harsh intervention from the police there, because you got that pronunciation direct from our Dutch friend Dan Hakkenberg.
I did, and I actually deliberately mispronounced it there in order to just poke the pronunciation police with a bit of a stick there.
Make sure he's still awake.
Make sure he's paying attention.
Yeah, sitting
Glenelagen.
Sitting eating donuts in his Glenelagen. Pronunciation police car.
And what about the man who is counting down the days to, you know, the end of his career and who's never won Het Nieuwsblad, amazingly, Tom Boonen.
Tom Boonen.
It's Tom Boonen. You should know that by now, Richard.
Again, it was deliberate.
Well, we're keeping them busy, aren't we, the pronunciation cops? Yeah, it's a real gap in his list of wins, isn't it? But probably there's a reason for that. I mean, it's not
He's never won it.
Well, he's never won it. No,
never managed to cross the line first.
But Het Nieuwsblad, while it is a classic, a semi-classic, I mean, these definitions sort of move and change. It's for the first time, it's a world tour race. The field looks very, very strong. But there's a good distance between now and the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, which are the big two. And for a lot of his career, Tom Bonen was preparing for those two big races, as he will be this year. And so, you know, it's a rare old thing that a rider is really pinging at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and then really pinging at the Tour of Flanders, you know, because, you know, the preparation, the upward trajectory towards the Tour of Flanders means that they perhaps won't be at their very best this weekend. And that's something that I'm really interested to see from the Cannondale team, because I know Jonathan Vaughters, who has no actual practical experience of riding these races but is really passionate about them, has built a team around Sepp van Marck. If you look at their roster, they've got Sebastian Langeveldt and Sepp van Marck, who won Het Nieuwsblad in 2011 and 2012, so two past winners in the team. And the pressure is kind of on van Marck right from the start of this Classics campaign.
Always is, isn't it?
It always is for, you know, Belgian riders.
Because he's such not one-dimensional, but, he, you know, the size of him, physique, his skill set, makes him very, very well suited to the Cobble Classics and perhaps not an awful lot else. So, you know,
unlike, say, last year's winner Greg Van Avermaet, who mm-hmm. won a stage of the Tour de France and then, of course, won the Olympic road race gold medal as well, and a few more strings to his bow. You know, Ian Stannard, who is a, you know, a classics engine, but also slots into a very strong support role with Team Sky. But you're right, yeah, Van Marck is he's an A-lister for these races. Yeah.
Luke Rowe is another one to look out for. Tesh Benoit, and I've said his name correctly. Tesh Benoit, the Lotto Soudal rider, rode very well in the Algarve. I think Eva actually said that she'd been impressed by how well he rode. And, you know, he's more of an all-rounder, but he's ridden well at Het Nieuwsblad before.
But the reason the race is different is because, you know, it's not necessarily that selective towards the end. The Molenberg comes quite a long way from the finish. There's the Lipovenstraat and the Paddenstraat sections of cobbles, which are, you know, difficult. They're very difficult, and often we do see a group, you know, we kind of see a group get away and then the chasers kind of throw in the towel, and then you know, then there's a sort of, well, last year's finish up the hill to the Citadel Park in Ghent was a thrilling finish between Van Avermaet and Sagan and Benoit, and I think one or two others. A few years ago, remember Ian Stannard pulled off the, you know, he slayed the Quick Step riders, didn't he? 3-1, and Stannard pulled it off. So we've seen in recent years, you know, the race doesn't settle into perhaps the same, the race does settle into that sort of pattern where one or two or a small group of riders will get away on that run in, and then it's just a battle of the toughest, really. It's not one where there's a strategic climb in the last 20 kilometres where it all kicks off.
It's a great curtain raiser, though, for the other cobbled classics and cobbled races. You know, it's very, you know, it always gives you a nice little, it's an appetizer, isn't it?
Yeah, and as we speak midweek, the weather over there is cold and wet, which the Belgian fans will love. I mean, you know, cold and wet will make it tough on race day. It's been cold in recent years, but I'm thinking about when Ian Stannard won Kerner Brussels Kerner in absolutely filthy, freezing, wet conditions, and really that was it's almost a last man standing sort of affair. If the weather is really bad, then you could see an epic police here.
Well, listen, let's leave it there, Lionel. You'll report back next week from Het Nieuwsblad, Daniel from the desert, and me from my kitchen. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Cycling Podcast, online every week and daily during the Grand Tours, on iTunes, Audioboom, and thecyclingpodcast.com. If you like what we do, please leave a review on iTunes. This week's show has been produced by Matt Field.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.